At around the time Xerxes was leaving Sardis, a delegation from Sparta was heading north to attend a congress of the allies at the Isthmus, midway between the Peloponnese and northern Greece. Its mood would have been a good deal less cheery than the great king's. The spring of 480 BC was decidedly not the best of times. That more than 1 million barbarians were making for their city was sobering enough, yet not even the ultimate in invasion scares could entirely eclipse for the Spartans a more traditional source of paranoia. Admittedly, the Argives had not yet openly committed themselves to the cause of the great king, nor, however, as the Spartans were all too painfully aware, had they pledged themselves to the allies. Worse, the Spartans had applied for a long-range forecast from Apollo. The Pythioi, returning from the oracle, had brought their royal masters, Leonidas and Leotychides, a most alarming message. "Your fate, O inhabitants of the broad fields of Sparta, is to see your great and famous city destroyed by the sons of Perseus. Either that, or everyone within the borders of Lacedaemon must mourn the death of a king sprung from the line of Heracles." It was not merely that either Leonidas or Leotychides appeared to have been given a death sentence. There was also, in the description of the apocalypse that would otherwise overwhelm Sparta, a sinister and typically Delphic ambiguity. Who precisely were the sons of Perseus? The Persians? The Argives? Both? Ahead of them, drawing ever closer, the Persians. Behind them, eyes fixed brightly on their backs, the Argives. Sons of Perseus, both. It was scarcely surprising that the Spartan delegates were jumpy. Before this rising tide of menace, it appeared that the allies had only one policy: retreat. Whisperings that the Persians were invincible grew louder. Such was the talk even in those cities committed to resistance when, in late May, news that the great king and his army had safely crossed the Hellespont broke like a thunderclap over Greece. It was in Athens that the shock was felt most keenly. Facing the prospect not merely of defeat, like the citizens of other cities, but of obliteration, the Athenian people in their extremity turned for guidance to Apollo. Leaving Attica, skirting warily past Thebes, climbing the foothills of Mount Parnassus, the Athenian emissaries were soon on the winding and increasingly lonely road that led between jagged peaks and past walls of fissured rock to Delphi. Once they had arrived there, they were led first through the cluttered gaudiness of the shrine to the Castalian spring, and then, having purified themselves in its freezing waters and offered up a sacrifice before the flames of the eternal fire, back to the temple itself. At the far end of the inner sanctuary, obscured by a jumble of ancient treasures, the Pythia waited for them, sunk within deepest shadow. The Pythia, an old woman in a young girl's dress, appeared almost a thing of grotesquerie, ill-suited, certainly, to be the vessel of golden Apollo. Already, however, as vapours from the cauldron she was perched upon caressed her parted thighs, she was shuddering with mantic ecstasy. The trance had come upon her. The Athenians, guided by the priests, took their seats beside the doorway. And at once the Pythia, without even waiting to hear their question, began to spasm with the urgency of her possession by the god. "Why sit down, you wretches?" she cried, her accent distorted and terror-stricken. "Get out of here! Flee, flee, flee to the ends of the world!" Words spewed out in horror, conjuring up images of carnage, fire, and annihilation. The god of war was coming. The temples of Athens would burn. Black blood would drown the city. "Go, go, leave the sanctuary, surrender to your grief." Tottering out weakly into the sunlight, the Athenian emissaries slumped down in despair. So, all was settled then. Their city's doom was at hand. Or was it?